Okay, well, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Julie Johnson, and I'm based here in the San Francisco Bay Area in the United States, and I'm joined by my colleague Madeline Winter in Sydney, Australia. And we're really excited that you've joined us today. We know you're busy, so thank you for taking out the time in your day or your evening or your morning. We have a lot of time zones covered here. So we're going to talk about using Parenting by Connection with preteens today, and we hope to give you some useful information and some things that you can try in your family that will help you prepare for this time and to really keep the connection going and to repair any tough spots that have developed. Towards the end of the call, we will definitely take some questions, so there'll be a little Q&A at the end of the call, and we'll have you raise your hand with a star two if you'd like to ask a question. But right now, but everyone's on lecture mode right now, which means that we have everyone else muted so that we can kind of block out some of the outside interferences. So while we're waiting for people to still join the call, I'm going to introduce Hand-in-Hand Parenting. And we probably have a lot of people on the call today, which is great, so we want to give people a chance to kind of settle in. So Madeline and I are both certified instructors with Hand-in-Hand Parenting, and Hand-in-Hand, as some of you might know, is a nonprofit organization based in Palo Alto, California in the U.S., and we offer classes and support groups in person and online, and we have articles, booklets, and podcasts, online discussion group. We also do lots of free teleseminars like this one, and we offer trainings for parents as well as professionals. And so our approach is called Parenting by Connection, and this approach offers what we call listening tools that can help us put our relationship with our children at the center of family life. So the idea is that the highs and lows of family life need to be understood within the context of our relationship with our children. And the main ideas behind this approach are that parents need and deserve support for the emotional work of parenting, but also that our children are born to feel connected with us. And this sense of connection is what they need in order to learn, to develop friendships, and to build resilience and confidence as they grow. And when children don't feel connected, their behavior can easily go off track, and they often let us know, usually indirectly. And when it does go off track, surprisingly, fostering laughter and play and setting limits and supporting children to have big, hearty cries and tantrums actually help our children feel more connected to us. And there has been brain science in the last number of years that that has validated this, and having those emotional upsets, emotional moments, can help them really work through difficult behaviors. So we'll just do a quick little introduction of ourselves. Again, my name is Julie Johnson, if you've just joined us. I'm a certified instructor with Hand in Hand, and I've known about Parenting by Connection, this approach, for a long time. I was a teacher, a middle and high school teacher, but it wasn't until my son was born that I really started using some of these tools. He's now almost six, and I have an 11-year-old stepdaughter, and I found that Parenting by Connection has really helped me with some of the challenges of navigating a blended family. And I started teaching this approach to parents and caregivers a few years ago. So, Madeline, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Madeline Winter, and I'm, as Julie said, I'm in Sydney in Australia, and Parenting by Connection is a worldwide phenomenon these days. You can find things to do just about anywhere. And I'm the mother of a 10-and-a-half-year-old girl, and I've been using Parenting by Connection for over 20 years, mostly with other people's families. And when I had my own daughter, it really made, this approach made sense of everything she did and much of what I was seeing around me, and I was inspired to start sharing it more actively with other parents and became a certified instructor with Hand-in-Hand Parenting. So that's a little about me. We thought we'd just outline what we're going to talk about today, so you have a picture of where we're going. We want to spend a bit of time giving you a definition of what a preteen is and teens or adolescents. We want to talk a little bit about the adolescent brain and what's going on. We'll talk about the situation for preteens, what they're trying to get their heads around and how that plays out a bit, the situation for parents at this stage, and we want to talk about the good news, about how the Parenting by Connection listening tools can help to keep us in good shape and help us give our children a hand through this stage and keep us well connected with each other. And as Julie said, we'll make some time toward the end to answer some of your questions.
Okay. Okay, great. So, yeah, to start, we wanted to give a definition for preteen so that we're all, and for adolescents, so that we're all sort of on the same page as we're talking about this. So when we say preteen, we're talking about a child between the ages of 8 and 12. And when we say teenager, that definition has actually changed over the years. And we're going to use Dr. Dan Siegel's definition. Siegel is a neuropsychiatrist and author of several books about how parenting can be informed by brain science. And he defines adolescence as extending from 12 to 24. So that's a long period, and that's well beyond what we normally think of as the teen years. And then there are a couple big takeaways that we think are important here. And one of them, which can be hard for us to remember about our preteens, is that they actually really want us, even when it looks like they don't. They still want us at, 9, 10, 13, 16, even when they're pushing us away or telling us that they hate us. And this can be hard to remember for a variety of reasons. And especially as young people get more independent and more social, we want to keep that in the forefront of our mind. Ellen Galinsky, who's a researcher, and she's the president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute in the United States, which is in New York City, I believe, and she conducted interviews with over 1,000 children, and they were doing a study that measured how they felt about family relationships. And one of the things that they found in their study is that young people really want us to hang in there, even when they're pushing us away. So we wanted to highlight that point. And she interviewed young people from ages 8 to 18. And one of the children in her interviews, one of the teens, said, when we're teens, we're so busy pushing our parents away that when we want them, it's hard to ask. And another boy said, I'm more comfortable if my parent just notices that there's something wrong and says it, because I find it hard to break that barrier, but I really do want them. So I think part of our job is to really notice how they're doing and who they are now as they're changing and growing, even when it feels like they may not want us around. And in a few minutes, we'll talk about some of the ways to really get in there with them and to stick around, even when it looks like they don't want us. Because even at this time, our job is not done. I know that some parents, when their kids, move into the teen years, it feels like, our job is coming to an end. But it's not. And in some ways, they want us more than ever. So, and then another takeaway here is that even though, we know that the preteen years can be challenging and can be difficult, it's also a really exciting time. And because of some of the brain changes that are taking place in older children, they start thinking in new and different ways, and they engage socially in a different way than in earlier years, and there's a creative kind of exploration that takes place. So there's this, sometimes a level of excitement and enthusiasm for life during this time.
Cool. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about those brain changes. Understanding, I'm not quite sure why, but Dan Siegel wrote a book called Brainstorm last year, and it's worth a read, and it's good. If you're interested, you can look him up on YouTube, which is actually the easiest way to get the sense of what he's talking about. But for me, understanding that the changes that are happening are not just these wild hormones about which we can do nothing, but a series of quite clear brain changes has made a real difference to how I've looked at this age. And those brain changes which are happening for children at this age. What's driving many of the commonly associated behaviours with adolescents, the moodiness, the emotional spark and volatility, young people's vulnerability to stress and addiction at this age, the tendency on the one hand to feel bored and on the other hand to take unwise risks and seek out novelty and adventure, which also fuels a capacity to solve problems in creative ways, and the increased importance of their social connections and the big focus on peer relationships that happens through this period. And those behaviours have tended to give adolescents a bad rap, but Dan Siegel says that it's better to understand them as sort of the necessary changes that have to happen to propel young people toward independence. And they offer us the opportunity to make sure that our lives are as dynamic and fulfilling and socially connected as possible so that we make adulthood look attractive to young people. And for those of us who've got to this stage of parenting, sometimes a little bit tired and worn out, that can be a bit of a challenge. And he also argues that we can do a lot to support and shepherd our young people through this phase. It'll be challenging, but it really doesn't have to be dreadful. Our young people are figuring out the world sort of completely for a second time, and in fact the brain pathways that weren't used in childhood are being pruned and eliminated, and the connections that are left behind are being strengthened so that they can focus in a much more concentrated way on stuff. And this is a messy process. Dan Siegel likens it to a construction site and says, you know, the plumbing and the electricity may not be working, but that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the building. It just means that it's a reconstruction project. And it's a huge process. It takes up a lot of our preteens' brain power as they're sort of gearing up towards that. And there's a way in these years that the bond between you and your child goes underground, and your child is less able than they were to reassure you that you count and that they need you. And you really do just have to trust that they want you no matter what it looks like. And most of us are going to need a place to go to where we can kind of talk about how it feels to to be not able to tell so clearly that they really want us in their lives.
Okay. So let's. We wanted to look at some of the messages that young people get from our society about themselves, because there are several things that work together to make things tricky for young people, particularly as they get into the preteen and teen years. And one of these things is that young people are systematically disrespected, so that their ideas and opinions are treated often as unimportant, or they're treated as less intelligent or less capable than adults. And also that the teen years tend to get a bad rap in general. So we hear people saying things like, oh, you think she's difficult now, just wait until she's a teenager, or parents roll their eyes when they talk about teens or say disparaging things about them. And so young people start to internalize these messages and stereotypes, and they take them in, and then they often kind of shoot them back out at other people, through anger or meanness or a surly attitude. And the other thing that happens around this time is that preteens tend to get less playful and more serious. Life just gets more serious. And I remember when my stepdaughter turned 9 and she suddenly started putting some of her toys and stuffed animals outside the door of her room. And when I asked her what she wanted to do with these things, she said, well, I don't need them anymore because I don't play anymore. And it wasn't actually that she didn't play anymore. She played with her brother sometimes, her younger brother sometimes. She still engaged in these imaginary games with friends. And she did play, but it was just interesting that she had this idea that she was a big girl now and that these things represented maybe her childhood or her kind of the babyish times. And the other idea is that around this time, it becomes even more risky to show feelings at this age. So
I mean, much earlier when children are younger, the sort of emotional release process gets shut down. And we hear all around us it's not okay to cry, it's not okay to tantrum or to show our feelings, particularly when we go to school. And children learn to keep things inside of them. And by the time they reach their preteens, this message is even stronger than ever. And they certainly don't want to show these tears or upset out in public in front of their friends, where they might be chastised or teased. And so this sort of natural healing process that people naturally go through when something is challenging or upsetting starts to really get shut down around this time. Madeline, do you want to talk about situation for parents?
Sure. I was just going to add on the end there, though, you know, like my daughter comes home and announces to me as a badge of honor that something hard happened at school and she didn't cry. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's very important not to show the feelings out there. For us, there's a whole bunch of things going on. What I've noticed is that we get busier often in a different kind of way. Like early parenting has its own busyness, but I think released from the intense workload of early parenting, I see families get really busy when their children move into their preteens. And it tends to be a busyness that's not so much, perhaps this is the difference from early parenting, it's not so much focused on parenting. And often it's focused on paid work. And work has a dynamic that doesn't easily fit with family life, and it can leave us stressed and tired and depleted. And in her interviews with young people, Ellen Galinsky, in the study that Julie referred to earlier, she asked young people if they had one wish, what would they change about the way their mothers and fathers' work affects their life? And they answered, even more than wanting to spend more time with their parents, which was really high on the list, they wanted their parents simply to be less stressed and less tired. And they were quite worried about us and the effect of work on our lives. I think what goes with this is a kind of different kind of isolation from happens in early parenting. While it can be quite isolating being a new parent, certainly once we get the hang of it, it can also be a time of a lot of connecting and relationship building and sharing of information and support around parenting. And we can certainly I could much more easily choose my children's friends based on how well I got along with their parents. And that's not so easy to do anymore. And it makes the building of relationships around parenting just a little bit harder. And our opportunities to connect with other parents are more limited, I think. And our conversations are less about parenting and more about other things. We're also carrying the load of 10 years or more of parenting. And we haven't, you know, I don't know that there's any parent on the planet, however well-resourced, who will have had enough time to kind of process each stage of parenting that they would really feel ready for the next one. And we can all tell, I think, that this stage that we're moving into, you know, is different and has a lot of challenges in it. And I think sometimes we look at it and think, oh, God, I wish I didn't have to do this again. So there's some work we need to do there. And the other thing that's happening, and this happens all the time in parenting, but it has particular bite at this age, is that we were once 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 or 15 too. And every time we look at our child, we're reminded of our lives at that time, at that time in our lives. And we're not necessarily aware of this happening. A lot of it happens at a level below awareness, but for sure it's happening and it influences our responses and our reactions and our flexibility in the face of our children and the challenges that they hand us. And for many of us, the preteen years were years when things really got harder. And, you know, I think if I asked most of you if you would gladly go back to those years, there wouldn't be, there'd be a few, but there wouldn't be that many people who'd stick their hands up. You know, we tended to walk away from that as fast as we could. I'm reminded of a story. I was working with a mother recently whose daughter was in year five, and they were getting into difficulties because she was finding it, her child was having big social challenges, and the mother was finding it really hard not to give her daughter advice on how to handle it. And it was a real struggle not to resist telling her daughter to stay away from this group of girls and telling her daughter what she thought of these girls. And the trouble was that that just made the daughter feel overwhelmed because she couldn't implement her mum's advice at school, and I think ended up feeling bad about that and basically stopped telling her mum what was going on. And I offered her mum some listening time. And I think often when there's something that we're really feeling strongly about or we're having trouble keeping our mouth shut about, if that's what is coming up, it's a sign that there's some part of our own story that is being triggered. And I asked her, what was it like when you were 10? And she told several heartbreaking stories about how lonely she was at school and about how hard it was that her parents had only really ever given her advice that she couldn't implement, and that made her feel even more alone. And after she'd talked about it for a while, she said, you know, I reckon that the teachers would have a good perspective on this problem. Maybe I should go and talk to them. And it was like once she'd relieved her own burden of tension, she could think about a different way to solve the problem. And I find that listening time can work like that, that things that we've not thought of pop into our heads. And one of the things I notice is that after getting listened to, I'm much more likely to think about how to get help. I think there's a way that we get stuck as parents. It's a real struggle to ask for help. The other things that happen is that we worry a lot. I think that's actually one of the hallmarks of parents. And we tend to get more and more focused on the negative, on what's wrong and what's not happening. And connected with this, I think, is that our relationship with our child now really has some history, and there are some places that are probably not working. Chances are that if you get on a call like this or get yourself along to a talk, there's something there that you're really needing a hand with and you're wanting to have go better. And in fact, what may need to happen is some repair work in order to set the ground or loosen the ground up for tackling the problem more directly. And sometimes just focusing on connection actually solves the problem. And another story I'm reminded of, a mother came to work with me about 6 months ago, and she was locked in a series of battles with her daughter over everyday issues. Her daughter was talking back. They couldn't sit at a meal together. She was getting in trouble at school. It was just the whole relationship was defined by this kind of series of what I don't know if you use this word in the US, but we would call them spats, just fighting all the time. And the mother was really distressed by this and had tried timeouts and punishments and rewards, and that didn't seem to be working. It just seemed to make things worse. So I recommended to her that for a couple of weeks she really stop having these arguments and resist the temptation, and instead organise a couple of days where they got to spend a few hours together just doing what her daughter wanted to do. And in that time, I told her that she needed to be interested and enthusiastic and delighted in her child and really practice. I think this is a practice, something we actually often have to practice. It's really practice enjoying her daughter. And this is a variation of what we call special time, which some of you will be familiar with, but it's a clear amount of one-on-one time where we put aside our worries and concerns and distractions and put our full attention on our child, and we decide to enjoy them fully and be open to whatever they want to do. And this was hard for this mother to do. She had to have a fair number of listening times where she ranted and raved about her daughter's bad behaviour, and she was worried that letting her daughter get away with it. But she was brave, and in special times she didn't mention any difficulties. She didn't raise sore issues or try to pry or give advice. She just put her full attention on her daughter and delighted in her and walked alongside her. I think they went shopping one time, and I think another time her daughter did several different things, including sitting her mum down and showing her all of her favourite music videos on YouTube, which wasn't something her mum had been at all interested in doing. And just the other day, the mother texted me and said, you know, I wanted to tell you this week we've all been sitting down at the table having dinner together, and everyone's been talking and listening about how their days have gone, and my daughter wanted us all to talk about something we'd learned in the day. It was great. So that's just a story about how sometimes putting our attention on connecting and having our young people experience us as alongside them and approving of them can really shift things in our relationship. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So we've touched on, and a little more than touched on, some of what are called the listening tools, which make up the Parenting by Connection approach. And we want to go into that a little bit deeper now. Madeline already mentioned a listening partnership, and we'll talk about that a little more, as well as something called play listening and how we can continue playing with our older children. And we may have time to say a little bit more about special time. So, Madeline, do you want to talk about listening partnerships?
Sure. Some of you may be familiar with listening partnerships. I regard them as sort of the foundation. I think of it as a triangle, and we have listening tools that are about connecting, and we have listening tools to use with our children that are about setting limits and correcting things that need correction. But at the bottom of the triangle, the base, is the listening partnership, which is where we get the support that we need in order to be able to really keep thinking about our young person and keep our own agenda and our own issues clear. I find it an invaluable tool for my parenting. And it's where we make an agreement with another adult to swap an agreed amount of time listening to one another. First, one person talks, and then when the time's up, we swap, and the other person listens. So we swap over, and the person who was the talker listens. And when we're listening, it's really different from a conversation. We don't offer opinions. We don't offer advice. We don't interrupt to tell our own story. Some people are really good listeners, but I find most of us, when we first start this, that the main thing we need to do is just shut up and listen. It's pretty basic. Mm-hmm. And as we get to know our listening partners better, we can do more things that help to draw out people's stories. And one of the things that makes this work is that whatever is said is completely confidential. And that means that we can talk about anything that's happening. And I think that gets particularly important as our kids head into rocky years. And it's pretty frightening to think that, you know, what you tell someone might end up around the schoolyard, or that you might come in for someone's opinion about the thing that you've just opened up and told them. And it's really important that we don't do that, and we don't mention it anywhere. And what it does is it gives us an opportunity to talk about how our parenting is going, how we feel about the places we haven't done as well. I think by the time we're at this point in parenting, we've often got things that we know we didn't do as well as we wanted to, and there's some regret that needs to be sort of talked about in order to put it behind us so we can keep thinking. We get to offload about the negatives and reach for what we love and admire about our young people. I find having a good complaint can go a long way towards making it sort of possible to notice what's going well. So I'll complain in my listening partnership, and I'll notice what's going well in my relationship with my young person. And I think it gives us a place where we can regularly ask ourselves the question, what was it like when I was this age? This is always important to ask, but it's especially important at this stage. And in fact, my husband and I regularly swap 5 minutes listening time every morning, and we've decided that once a week we're going to give ourselves the assignment of asking, what was it like when you were 10? And we find that Yes, we wouldn't go back there if we didn't ask each other that question. But once we do, with a thoughtful listener by our side, it's a real sense of relief to talk about it. It's like it's sitting there, and we never got to talk about it when we were young. But there's something energizing about going back and having a look. You find things that you'd sort of forgotten and which come to light, and often it makes real sense of why the thing that's happening now is causing you difficulty. And this isn't specifically about teens, but we're moving house and we're in the process of packing and unpacking, and I was really feeling terrible about it. And I had a short listening partnership, and in that time I remembered that it was the point at which my parents divorced. And there's ways these big things that have happened to us, the feelings from them are coming up because this experience reminds us of the earlier experience, but we don't kind of really know why it feels so hard, and we can often, it drives our behaviour sometimes in ways that we don't want it to. Julie, I thought you had an anecdote there.
Yeah, I was, there's a story actually that Patty Whistler, the founder and program director of Hand in Hand, once told, and it's about a father that she knew that had a 17-year-old daughter, and at one point his daughter became really angry at him and stopped talking to him, and she actually didn't talk to him for a couple weeks, and it was a really, as you can imagine, a hard time for him, for both of them, and he really didn't know what to do. And he was someone that actually did exchange listening time with another parent, and so he decided to set that up with somebody, and he called this person who he could talk to about parenting and about his early years. And what came up when he started talking was that was his relationship with his father and what that was like, and apparently it was a very difficult relationship, and the father basically told him that he wasn't good enough to amount to anything, that he was a mess, that you know, that he actually wished he had never had him. I mean, really, really hard things. And he told him these things almost every day. And so, as you can imagine, they had a very, very hard and disconnected relationship. And the son, who was now the father, eventually left home and, on the one hand, was very relieved and glad to get out of the house and away from his father, but also left very sad that he never had the kind of relationship that he wanted with his father. And he actually spent time on the phone that day just crying and crying and really sort of sobbing about his relationship with his father. And then that night he went to his daughter's room around bedtime, and he always went into her room and said goodnight. But this time he went in and he sat on her bed, and he just sat there for a minute, and she actually came over and she just curled up into his lap and she started to cry. And she cried and cried and cried about how difficult things were for her at that time in her life. And this actually sort of started the repair process between them. And it really helped them to start to reconnect. So it can be really powerful what can happen when we get the support that we need to then be able to go and support our children. So we also wanted to talk a little bit about play today, because young people, as I mentioned earlier, around this time, around preteen years, they start to play less and things get more serious. And it's actually so important to have playful ways to connect with our older children. Play can really nurture young people's self-esteem and their confidence. It can help us to get out of some of the ruts that we've gotten into with our older children. And as we, you know, if we are feeling very stuck in certain battles with our children and feeling hopeless, play can really, really start to shift things. It can be really useful. So, how do we do it? As with younger people, with parents who have younger people, we often recommend that they notice what makes their children laugh and do it again. But obviously those things change as our children get older. And so we can try things that used to make them laugh, but often we need to sort of up the ante a bit. So, for example, there's an instructor of hand-in-hand, of Parenting by Connection that I know who has a 9-year-old, and sometimes she even still asks for a horsey ride, but now that horsey ride has to be a lot more vigorous, where the mom is bouncing quite hard and her daughter has to figure out how to stay on. So the mom is thinking about, you know, how to make things more challenging, how to be more creative. And another thing that she does with her 9-year-old is when they go to her grandfather's house, they set up an obstacle course for her daughter, and it actually is similar to some of the games that she's playing on the computer. And so, for example, at her father's house, they have one of those coffee tables that has a kind of cushiony top that comes off and on. And so her daughter will stand on that, and then the grandfather will be a little bit in front of her and maybe waving his arms slowly, kind of like a windmill. And she'll have to figure out how to jump through, through his arms or away from his arms so that she doesn't touch his arms. And then the grandmother will, like, gently be throwing pillows towards her, and she has to figure out how to dodge the pillows. And then her mom will set up another obstacle. So there's a bit more challenge to the games that we used to play together. And the other thing is that, especially for children that really don't want to play with us and show us that, we want to go towards them like a happy little puppy. So in the morning, you know, when they get up, maybe they're sitting at the table, you might kind of lean in and just say something like, your hair smells so good. I just want to give you a nuzzle on the neck. And you want to try to flirt with them a little bit, or go over to them and say, oh, I haven't seen you all day at the end of the day. I just want to give you a zillion kisses. You can imagine what your child might say and push you away, or, you know, like, oh, mom or dad, come on. But I think it's worth it to come towards them in this kind of playful, happy puppy kind of way. And, you know, and sometimes they'll let you kind of snuggle them. Sometimes they won't. But you're just showing them that you're noticing them, you want to be around them. And the other thing is, there's another, I know a parent of a daughter who at the time was 10, and they started a butt swatting game. So her daughter would try to swat her butt, and then the mother would run away, and then they'd kind of chase each other around, and they'd do this kind of dance of each person was trying to swat the other person's butt, and they'd be running around and laughing. There was a lot of laughter, because sometimes even, you know, chasing is preteen, still works, actually. So one day they had done this game off and on a couple times, and then one day they were both in the kitchen and they were preparing dinner, and the daughter was actually helping her, and then something got said that made the daughter angry, and she went into her bedroom and she slammed the door, and the mom is thinking, I just want to get dinner on the table, I'm too tired to deal with this, I don't want to go in there and try to draw her out. And so she didn't. And a couple of minutes later, her daughter came out and walked over to her and swatted her on the butt and ran away. And her mom said something like, hey, like, I can't let you swat my butt like that. Come here. And she ran after her. And they got into this game again. And they were kind of running around in circles, chasing each other, trying to swat the butts. And that game actually helped to really pull her daughter, but also the mom, out of this tension that had built and this argument that had ensued. And, I think by this age, children often have a good understanding of where things get hard for their parents, and they can really tell where our struggles are. Sometimes they even start articulating it. But because the mom didn't have the bandwidth to draw her daughter out, the girl came out of her room and actually initiated this game, which I thought was pretty great on her part, and that's because they had this history of play and wrestling as well. But that she was able to then use that to help herself get out of that tough spot. So things like wrestling, pillow fights, these are still really great things to do at this age, and they can really help with some of the difficulties and the battles that we get into with our children. And also just sort of a side note, just because affection becomes often diminished as our children get older, so certainly in public, they don't want us to hug them or show affection as much, you know, around their friends or near school. But sometimes when we play these physical games, it's just, you know, a way to show our love and affection for them. I know that my stepdaughter, still at 11, still likes to do something called a steamroller, which we lie on top of each other on the bed and then just try to roll over. And that, just even trying to roll now because we're both so heavy, just makes us laugh. And now she says, "You lie on top of me," because she's so big now. And just, you know, that just that process of just one little, you know, try to roll is just really makes her laugh. So
lovely. There's a couple of really nice articles actually on the website. One's called The Vigorous Snuggle. And I'm not sure if it's the same article, but there's one about what to say, something about how was school today and how to respond to, we'll send you the links to them, but to use that kind of playfulness as a way of connecting after school instead of asking how was school today, because I don't know about you, but I don't often get much information about how things are, but I can tell that things happened, and connecting can help, and then later on, connecting through laughing can help, and then later on, she'll talk some more.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd recommend that Vigorous Snuggle article. So I want to talk just briefly about special time. I've talked a little bit about it. It's one of the things that I've come to an appreciation of as I've used it more, and in particular as I've used it in my own relationship with my daughter, where I used it a lot with other people's children, but when I got to be using it with someone I was in such an intimate relationship with, I could really see the remarkable and subtle ways that special time works to connect us, to create emotional safety and space for our children, but there's also a really important working through of things that happens when a child gets to be the one in control of what's happening. And the phrase we use is, in fact, this is a space where young people get to be in control of their relationship with us, which it's taken me a while to understand. But the bottom line is that we want to tell them that we will, for a period of time, do whatever they want us to do. Ellen Galinsky's research, again, found that even though they're becoming more independent at this stage and you might be sending them off more for sleepovers, they really want time with you. And it's not just time spent driving from one activity to the next, but time hanging out together with no specific agenda and no real place to be. Special time is a great way to practice not having a specific agenda. And, so I think there's two pieces. One is the bit about just hanging around. It's really important, and I'm finding that we need to have a lot more time together as a family now, and she's actually asking for it more, whereas before, when she was younger, we were able to do tag team, you know, one of us would be with her while the other one went off and worked or did other stuff, and we'd sort of swap over. We had some time together, but I didn't feel at all, for instance, that I really needed to make sure that the evenings were not filled up with other activities. So she's asking for more hang-around time. And we can just bring a book or something light to do to go into our preteen's room or somewhere where they're sitting and just be next to them and not intrude. And I think what helps us to be in the right frame of mind is to understand what this thing called special time is. So it's a very effective way to be there with our children. It's a dedicated amount of time which can be timed and where we decide to put our attention fully on our child. We willingly join with them in whatever they whatever they want to do, we offer our delight and enjoyment of them. And it changes a little as they get older. She used to like to do acrobatic exercises, and sometimes my daughter would play out things in play. For a while there, she was looking at cooking shows a lot, and a lot of special time was acting out these cooking shows where I was giving specific instructions on how to chop and cut, and I learned about this thing called plating up. But as they get older, it can start to look a little bit more different. They may want to do more things outside the house. They probably need us to spend more time. 10 minutes here or there won't tend to do achieve what needs to be done. But even if it's a bit loose around the edges, and sometimes it doesn't work to announce special time as our children get older. Often if I announce special time, there's some way that it doesn't seem to happen. But I have found that I need to make times where I decide that that's what I'm going to do, even if I don't announce it. And I just decide that whatever's happening, I'm going to get in beside her, pour in the love and attention, get rid of the distractions, not answer the phone, not stir the pot on the stove, and just give her my undivided attention. It often happens these days around, I haven't given up scheduling, you know, formal special time, but it often happens these days where I have to really decide to go and sit with her and watch the television, which, you know, I could have a million listening partnerships on television and screens, but I have to drop my tension about that and just go and sit with her, because she's exploring, like, she watches interesting programs, she wants to tell me about it. I think there's a way she's been left alone to watch television a fair bit because it's an easy childminder, and we often connect around that in an important way. And another way may be to kind of go somewhere and pay give our children our sort of attention and enthusiasm when they're trying new things. I remember my friend, her boy was a skateboarder, and she used to spend hours with her heart in her mouth as doing her best to be enthusiastic about her boy's new and daring moves and jumps. And sometimes she'd have to escape to the toilet and text me and say, "Oh, my God, surely he's going to break his neck this time." Like, she had to let it out somewhere. But she found if she could do that, she could go back and be enthusiastic. And he just loved having her there. And their things went much easier between the two of them when she'd got to do a good chunk of that every week. So there's a few things about special time that are important, which I think I mentioned in the anecdote that I told earlier. But once we get to having kids where we've got a bit of history in our relationship, it's really important to understand that there are times we need to make where we don't bring up sore topics, where we don't ask a whole lot of questions, we don't pry into their lives, and we don't refer at all to any of the difficulties between us. We just choose to be focused on what's lovely about being with them. We're running a bit short on time, Julie, but you had a little story about special time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this was sometime last year, but I asked my 11-year-old, who was 10 at the time, what she wanted to do for special time, and she said, "I want to go jogging." And I thought, I wasn't in shape. I was like, I can only jog about a couple blocks, I was thinking. So, but I said, okay, and we got on our jogging clothes, and we went out, and as soon as we started down the block, and I'm, you know, huffing and puffing, and she says, my stepdaughter, she says, "So Julie, how are you? This is a good time to talk. You know, like we haven't connected lately." And so I just thought that was so great. And then she then proceeded to tell me some things that were going on at school, actually. And, you know, I was huffing and puffing, and unfortunately I couldn't respond a lot. But it was just, it was so great to spend that time with her. And then when we got back, we didn't spend long out there, but when we got back, we took showers, and then it was actually in the late afternoon, and she had to do homework, and I didn't have to push her to do her homework, but it was a nice day, and we sat outside, and She actually did her homework with me nearby outside, and just the rest of the day and the evening went so much better. So, but it was nice that she took that time to kind of check in with me. So.
Yeah. There's a lovely article. It's one of my favorites. It's called Special Time Teaches Me About My Son. It's actually with a 14-year-old, but it's really worth a read. It describes the way she decides to step out of her usual routine and do what her son wants to do. And there's this hilarious thing that happens where he gets to be the one who knows stuff and who's competent, which is a really important part of how we can help our kids. It's finding times sometimes when we're the less than, we're the one who doesn't know, and they get to be the competent one. And it's just a really sweet story of how that plays out and how it improves her relationship. I recommend it. Am I doing the summary?
Well, I think we're going to stop talking now because we only have a few minutes left. And we've gone over a lot of different things. That's a lot to wrap your mind around. So we'd love to see if anyone has any questions. And everyone's on mute now, but if you do have a question, you can press star 2 to raise your hand, and then we'll see you, and we'll pick up your line. Are there any questions out there about anything we've talked about anything that's coming up with your child or children?
Then we've got a hand.
Okay.
Do you want to take it, Julie?
Yeah. So let me unmute you. I don't know where you're calling from. Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi. My name's Kat. I'm from calling from Sydney in Australia.
Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering what the name of that article was again, the special time, and who wrote it and where I could read it.
Oh, okay.
It's on the Hand in Hand Parenting website, which is handinhandparenting.org. The best way to find your way around that website is actually to use the search function, I find. So if you plug in teens, preteens, or teenagers, you'll find all sorts of interesting stuff. But that article is called Special Time Teaches Me About My Son. And I think it's a mother in Oakland, so it's anonymous. But if you plug in, I actually put in fishing because I knew that what they do together is go fishing. If you put in fishing, it'll turn up that article.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay,
my pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, let's see. We have another call here on Skype, it looks like, with Claire. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I wasn't able to make the first part of the call, so I'm not sure if you've already covered this, but I'm really curious about if you've got any ideas around setting limits with preteens.
Madeline, do you want to go ahead and then I'll
Okay, all right. I will.
Yeah.
I think... good question.
It depends on the situation.
Yeah, it depends on the situation. And I do think that... Did you have something specific? Was there something specific that you're struggling with?
Well, I've been using hand-in-hand tools with my kids since they were little. And my 8-year-old now is just getting big and strong and fierce. And so where I would used to be holding him and, keeping everybody safe when he had some really big feelings and started raging, I just don't feel like I can keep myself safe in that situation anymore. Like, he's bitten me and left a big scar, and I just feel like he doesn't feel good about that. I don't want that on my body. But I'm really still feeling that he needs something to push against or, push up against and have resistance against. But I'm not quite sure how to provide that, really.
Yeah.
And, getting close enough because he really needs that closeness.
Okay. I think your sense that almost the most important thing is that you keep yourself safe, because he doesn't want to hurt you. And I think if we, if it ends up that we get hurt, it adds another layer of difficulty to the situation. So it's great that you're thinking about how to keep yourself safe. I don't know that there are any clear answers. If you've been using these tools since he was young, I've actually found that there are times when we can actually have a conversation about that, that our children develop a really quite sophisticated understanding of the process and of what's happening, and that outside of the time when you're in the middle of it, because when he's in the middle of it, he can't think so well. It's like his prefrontal cortex is shut down. He's in the middle of an emotional experience. But outside of that, you may be able to have a conversation with him and do a little bit of brainstorming about what, you know, what I really want to be there for you, and I can tell that you really need to push somehow. But what could we do that would help to keep me safe? And he may be able to, you may be able to come up together with some ideas about how to do that, whether it's that you, get yourself a thinnish sort of double bed mattress and wrap that around you, or you wrap him in something and he has to struggle to get out of it. Or, you know, I don't know if he's at the point of sort of tending to rush off and slam the door, but we often worry about that's sort of putting some too much space between us. But in fact, the tussle over whether the door gets to be closed or trying to get into the door when he's pushing on the other side actually can provide a safe thing for him to push up against and keep going with the feeling, without you being directly in the firing line of his anger.
Yeah.
So I think it's harder to have that conversation with a child who hasn't, who you haven't been listening to in this way for a long time. But it's worth a try. But he may be able to think with you about what you can both do when it comes up.
Yeah.
And I think it's a place where, you know, most of us were either watched or were the victim of, some kind of physical violence at some point in our life. And most of us have actually not had a chance to talk about that enough. And when our children are behaving violently, it reminds us of that, and that gets in the way of us being able to be as flexible as we need to be to keep ourselves out of the way of the punch or out of the way of the gnashing teeth. And you would not be wasting your time talking about your early memories to do with being physically assaulted or, anything connected with that in any way at all. It really will, you'll get quicker. If you clean up the places where your mind's paralysed there, you'll get quicker at anticipating his moves and figuring out ways to keep yourself safe. Julie, have you got anything you'd add?
No, I think that's great, and I was going to emphasize the listening time as well to really get to talk and, maybe scream or yell about, how painful it is when he hits you or bites you. That can be really important, and I also know moms who have, like Madeline said, bought kind of a spongy, spongy kind of noodle things where you can kind of whack each other with, during playtime, also, wrestling outside of those aggressive times can help. Also, when he does get aggressive, using pillows and, Madeline has mentioned this, but kind of blocking yourself with pillows or wrapping something around you, I think can be useful too.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Okay.
The other thing I'd add about that is that if your son is in that place a lot, it's really important to make sure that you balance your relationship with him. I don't know if you're getting to do special time with him at all, but it can get our focus can really get on whatever the difficulty is and how we might be able to shift that, or we're just handed this hard feeling he's got a lot of the time and feel like we're just on the back foot all the time, and the relationship can get defined and consumed by that. And it's really important to be structuring in at least as much special time as you're spending in that kind of limit setting and listening process with him. And you might want to set up a period where you really just focus on the special time. You know, for a couple of weeks you really put a big connection injection in there and you'll be able to back off. What sometimes that does is it loosens up the time when he's upset, so that it's less tight and there's less aggression and more sort of freely available sort of emotional release. Sometimes the aggression is what you have to get through to get to the emotional release. Sometimes the pushing is part of what needs to happen for that to happen. But definitely don't give up on those special times. They're a really important part of the total ingredient that will make it work.
Oh, thank you. That's awesome.
Thanks. Okay. Well, our time's up.
Yeah, we've come to the end of the hour, and we just want to make a couple announcements. You can, if you have any other lasting questions, you can find us. Our bios are on the handinhandparenting.org website, and our contact information is there. I actually have an in-person preteen workshop coming up on Sunday, May 3rd from 4 to 6 Pacific time, and that's held in Berkeley, California, if you happen to be local and in this area. And then, Madeline, did you want to announce
that
for
you? I have an online starter class starting on the 28th of April, but I'm also thinking I would love to do one for parents of preteens, which I actually hadn't managed to schedule. But I think if you're interested in the starter class is a six-week class which has marvelous video resources and a six-week call where you meet with a small group of other parents to talk about what you're figuring out and get your questions answered and get a bit of listening time. And often people build listening partnerships out of the relationships and the connections they make in those classes. And we run those classes in person around the place, but also online. I would love to run one for preteens. So if you're interested in that, probably contact me, my contact details. If you put Madeline Winter into the Hand in Hand website, you'll get to my bio page and there you'll be able to contact me. So let me know. It would probably be at this sort of time during the week, so Sunday afternoon or evening in the US and Monday morning here.
Okay.
Great.
Yeah, so I think that's it. We're going to wrap up, and thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today. We hope to hear from you in some way or another again, and thanks for taking out a little chunk of either your Sunday or your Monday morning.
Yeah. Thanks for being with us. It's a big step to take time out to get the resource that you need and not just keep struggling on your own. And do be in touch with us. We love to hear from you.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.